So the next session is about looking about what to do when you found that you've blundered slightly and you have to do some disease modeling. And the session is going to be led by, we just had a discussion about this. I tend to say Mark Mercola in honor of his Italian ancestry, but here I suppose it would be Mark Mercola. And he'll be joined by Fred Gage, and Robert Cass, Rocky Cass. All right, so Mark, would you like to take it away? Thanks.
So we have a nice session to close the meeting before the keynote. We're going to have three speakers, so two in addition to myself. The two other speakers are just fabulous. I think Rusty Gage needs no introduction to this audience. He's basically the person that we look to when we think about modeling neurological disorders. And then I have the great pleasure of introducing someone who is a new colleague of mine, a new collaborator, Robert Cass, and I'll tell you a little bit about him before he talks. I'm going to tell you about our work to look to chemical and functional genomics to look for targets for heart failure. We've been interested in this problem for many years, starting with the questions of what does it take to induce cardiomyocytes, thinking that ultimately what we would like to do is regenerate those cells that are lost due to injury. We've also have a parallel interest in the lab that I'll talk about as well today, and that's to look for drug targets that would be useful to sustain contractility in the failing heart. That's a clinically validated strategy. We all know that if you sustain contractility in the failing heart, you can use it to treat, you can treat heart failure. Regenerating the heart, as Jay discussed, especially from stem cells, endogenous stem cells, remains very controversial. So that's very much pie in the sky. But it's something that I would love to achieve. That is a pharmacological approach to regeneration. So this just illustrates the problem. On this slide, you can see, how does the pointer work? Oh, okay. You can see the large number of cells, up to a billion cells in the heart, can be lost due to ischemic injury. And this then translates over time into heart failure. So as I said, our focus is on boosting regeneration and separately to maintain contractility, both with pharmacological approaches. And that means identifying the drug targets or the processes and then trying to come up with drugs and eventually take those forward. So if you think about regeneration, where might new myocytes come from? So they could come from pre-existing myocytes. They could come from cells outside the heart that wander into the heart. They could come from endogenous progenitors. All of these sources are somewhat a matter of debate. So we've not used adult cells directly in the screens, but what we have used to develop our high-throughput assays are embryonic stem cell-derived progenitors. So we take ES or iPS cells, make them into progenitors, and put them into dishes. And so the schematic, very schematically here, you take a progenitor. This is actually an ES cell, but we take progenitors of the ES cells, put them in the dishes, add things to them, and hope you turn on cardiomyocytes. And this is one of our human ES modified lines that fluoresces red when it becomes a cardiomyocyte. So we can score it by high-throughput microscopy. So if you think about if this is an abbreviated form of a stepwise program to make a cardiomyocyte, you first have to make mesoderm and then progenitors and commit those progenitors, and then eventually you get myocytes. The logic is that these cells in the middle of the pathway here, the progenitors and the precursors here, resemble in terms of their gene and protein expression cells in the adult heart, so that if you had drugs that worked on each of these steps, you might be able to achieve a generation of new myocytes. And so, this is the transferring the platform. So with that in mind, we've over the years developed stage-specific assays where we take cells from one point, we add molecules to them, and we look to see if they transit to the next point. And so a lot of this work has been done in the lab by, a number of people, but in particular I'd like to acknowledge Paul Bushway, who was a student and is now a postdoc in the lab, and Eric Willems, a postdoc in the lab. And this shows roughly, or schematically, a diagram of what they do. They take these progenitors, put them in dishes, they assay them a few days later to see if they become myocytes, and you can do this by automated microscopy. If you get hits out of this, these screens. You get a look at small molecules. You can see that indeed they induce cardiomyocytes by flow cytometry. And through this approach, over the last few years, we've identified a number of molecules that are listed here. And these are our favorites. We have a Wnt inhibitor, and these molecules, once we get the hit, we work with typically with John Cashman at the Human Biomolecular Research Institute and his team of medicinal chemists. They turn them into much more user-friendly molecules. So a Wnt inhibitor was an early molecule that we discovered, and that fit the logic, the developmental biology logic, that you need to block Wnt signaling at a particular time in order to commit cells to the myocyte lineage. We also have discovered the first selective TGF-beta inhibitor, and that's a molecule I'll talk about. We have another molecule that came out of this work because we were trying to drug the Wnt pathway. We came up with a remarkably potent molecule. However, it's not terribly cardiogenic. It just blocks Wnt very potently. And so we've repositioned it and are studying it for colon cancer in particular. We have been trying to target pathways involved in microvasculature regeneration and have some success at that. And I'll talk about a molecule at the end for sustaining calcium contractility, calcium-based contractility. So this summarizes the work on the TGF-beta inhibitor that Paul and Eric did. And as well, Dennis Schad in John Cashman's lab did all the chemistry. So what we have with this molecule is, if you look at TGF-beta ligands, nodal, TGF-beta itself, activin, these interact with type 1 and type 2 transmembrane receptors. And so there's a family of receptors, family of molecules. Myostatin is another ligand. But TGF-beta itself is selective or works through the ALK5 receptor and its own type 2 receptor. And so the molecule that came out of a phenotypic screen turned out to be selective for TGF-beta, and you can see that reading out a target gene here. So if you dial in the molecule, ITD1, which we call inducer of TGF-beta degradation 1, you can see inhibition of a target gene dependent upon TGF-beta, but not activin, which targets these other receptors. So this molecule is the first selective receptor. First selective small molecule inhibitor of TGF-beta. Other small molecule inhibitors target the kinase of the type 1 receptors and are inherently then not selective for one type of TGF-beta receptor or another. And so this one is selective. But that's interesting for two reasons. One, how does it work? It's not a kinase inhibitor. And secondly, why is TGF-beta inhibition cardiogenic? So the molecule will clear TGF-beta receptors from the surface of the cell. And that's true whether you have exogenous TGF-beta receptors transfected into cells, shown here. You go from lots of receptor to low levels of receptor by treating with ITD1, and that's quantified here, as well as endogenous receptor, shown here in a few different cell lines. So what I've said then is that the molecule works by targeting the type 2 receptor and selectively taking it into the cell where it's degraded by the proteasome, and we have more data on this, but I don't have time to show it to you. But the type 1 receptor stays on the surface of the cell, and we don't fully understand that. But the biological question is even more interesting to us. Why is it that TGF-beta is important to make cardiomyocytes? And specifically, does TGF-beta play some role in the formation of these multipotent progenitors or committed precursors or driving one arm, all arms of this pathway? And so Eric treated human embryonic stem cells and mouse ES cells with the molecule at an early window of time when it is optimal, when it works optimally. And you could see here the result. You go from DMSO vehicle to ITD treated. And if you look at markers for different lineages, cardiomyocyte lineage, endothelial lineage, hematopoietic lineage, or smooth muscle, you find the molecule is selective for inducing cardiomyocytes and not the other lineages. So from that, another work, we conclude that TGF-beta basically suppresses the cardiomyocyte arm of differentiation from the multipotent progenitor, and that the molecule works because it suppresses TGF-beta. And TGF-beta is involved in a complex cascade from an early embryonic type of TGF-beta known as nodal. Nodal induces itself as well as TGF-beta, and then that persists after nodal goes off as TGF-beta. Okay, so that's interesting. But what's the critical switch? These are ES cells, and we want to make a drug that targets cells in the body. And so nodal might not be the relevant TGF-beta, but also we want to know the basic process that's needed to commit to make a progenitor and commit it to become a myocyte. So Wen-Xing Cai is a student in the lab who's finishing up, and she, and with collaborators in Lorenzo Buri's lab, have worked out a mechanism downstream of TGF-beta that we believe is the critical step in committing a progenitor to a cardiomyocyte. So this is work that started out as a developmental biology project, where we had known for years, in fact, that the endoderm induces a molecule known as Cerberus. And Cerberus does something to take uncommitted cells to become committed to the cardiac lineage. And over the years, other people have shown that Cerberus is a dual function inhibitor of BMPs and nodal. And of course, BMPs, nodals, and TGF-beta, as I'd shown you, are all inhibitory at this step of cardiogenesis. So whatever the key step is downstream of these three molecules here, acting perhaps in the nucleus of the cell. And so we were highly motivated by work in the skeletal muscle field, where the myogenic program, the skeletal myogenic program, is kicked in when chromatin remodeling complex becomes targeted to myogenic loci, opening up those loci, creating a conducive transcriptional landscape for myogenesis to occur. And the key part of this is recruiting the SWI-SNF complex to chromatin through interaction with a specific transcription factor in skeletal muscle, that's MyoD. And that works by MyoD creates a bridge with one of the non-catalytic subunits of the complex known as BAF60C. And so Benoit Bruneau at UCSF had shown that if you overexpress BAF60C, and there are two other variants, A and B, and they don't work as well at this, so it's having selectively BAF60C in the cell plus a cardiogenic transcription factor, GATA4, you'll induce ectopic cardiomyocytes in development. So we reasoned that Cerberus might in some way, and many other nodal and BMP inhibitors, controlling nodal and BMP, and that in some way that would control these signals. And this is the scheme, and I don't have time to go through all the data on it, but this is the scheme that she worked out, that nodal and TGF-beta suppress GATA4 and BAF60C, and BMP suppresses a contributing factor, TBOX5. And it's the combination of these three that recruit the chromatin remodeling complex to the appropriate sites in chromatin. So I'm going to show you the key experiment that shows that that we believe this is true. And the key experiment is based on predicated on the fact that Cerberus 1 siRNA, so if you come in and block this protein Cerberus, will block cardiogenesis. And so you can ask, what does it take to open and close chromatin at the target loci with and without the presence of Cerberus? So what gene to look at? Well, NKX2.5, this is a gene that's quintessentially cardiac progenitor or precursor gene, has two elements upstream. It has one element at -3 kb that makes the gene active in endodermal tissues, and it has another element at -9 that makes it active in cardiac. And so we did a chromatin accessibility assay where you take nuclei, you isolate their chromatin, you take nuclei and you incubate with a four-hitter enzyme that just cleaves the chromatin. And if the chromatin is open, the nucleosomes are all separated from each other. And if the chromatin is closed, it's more resistant to the enzyme. And by gauging the amount of resistance, you can tell what the degree of open or closed chromatin. So the experiment is shown here. If you look at this -9 kb element, in the black bar are just undifferentiated ES cells, you get a certain amount of digestion or accessibility, and we call that closed. Negative control siRNA, so just cells that have differentiated, and you differentiate them for a few days to the point where they make the precursors, and you look at how open the chromatin is, that level here we designate as open. But if you block BAF60C, it now closes the chromatin. If you block Cerberus, it closes the chromatin, okay? And nothing affects the gut enhancer. So this model suggests to us that Cerberus, which controls the TGF-beta level of TGF-beta family member signaling, is in some way able to control the commitment of cells to the cardiac lineages through the control of a chromatin remodeling complex. So we think this is the switch that makes a progenitor cell cardiogenic. So we think the ITD1 then will works in the adults or in our stem cell setting by blocking the TGF-beta and allowing the chromatin to open. Okay, so what's the implication of this? I don't think nodal is what's important in the heart in adults, but TGF-beta, I think, is important. So I've told you that TGF-beta blocks differentiation. The molecule comes in and makes differentiation occur. And in the adult heart, I think we postulate that a similar mechanism might be at play. And this might be at play because TGF-beta is part of the response that will promote the scarring. And so you've heard today a couple of people talk about the balance between fibrosis and scarring and regeneration. So we're not proposing anything fundamentally new there. What I'm proposing is the mechanism whereby that might occur, at least for the cardiomyocyte lineage, that it's occurring through TGF-beta, suppressing the complex that opens chromatin, creating the conducive landscape for differentiation. So what we've learned is we've gone from screening through a candidate drug target that we're now testing in vivo, and that have a concept that TGF-beta controls this balance. And together, that's target identification and validation. But this is drug discovery, as you've heard. And you've heard a lot of talks about linking what we do in academia to what pharma do. And so if this is drug discovery, and of course, we're way over here, and there's a lot to do to go from this point to this point. And I bring this up now because that molecule ITD1, going from screening to the point of considering taking it forward as a drug or understanding even how it works, took 7 years. So hardly high throughput. So you do this, you have this great automated, robots that can screen hundreds of thousands of molecules. And and Jake Schneider can empathize with this. You spend 7 years and you get one target and one molecule if you're lucky, or per person. So it's really low yield. So the rate limiting step is certainly not the screening. The rate limiting step, or what we want to do, is go through the proteome and figure out what proteins are new druggable targets. So, thinking about this problem, I became fond of the idea of screening microRNA libraries. And the reason being, are shown here, that microRNAs have evolved with their targets and target proteins that target nearly every biological process, but they target proteins that are critical in biological networks. So you can reveal nodal proteins for complex biology through microRNA screening. And there are very few of them. There are only about 1,500 microRNAs. So from a screen perspective, it's trivial to screen the whole murome. So as a proof of principle, Alex Collat and Wes McKeithen in the lab set up an assay very similar to the one I told you before, where they put mesendoderm progenitors in a dish, added microRNAs, and asked, can you figure out what pathways control this initiating step in cardiogenesis, basically distinguishing the earliest precursor from cells that go on to make your gut. And this was published a year ago or so I'm not going to go through it all, but basically you can do a screen, you can find a bunch of mirrors that hit. We collaborated with Shankar Subramaniam in bioengineering at UCSD. Shankar's not here, right? Okay. So he made a radiculome, one of these networks of proteins, 2,000 proteins all talking to each other. And Wes and Kola went through this using siRNAs to key nodes in signaling pathways and discovered, indeed, the TGF-beta nodal pathway is important for this process. So that led to this concept, again, supporting what I was telling you before, that nodal puts the brakes on the cardiogenic pathway and will then activate an endoderm cells. So this is great. Screening microRNAs can give you target information. So we want to apply this to something, and so what we're applying it to is the control of contractility. We're applying it to lots of different things in the lab right now, but this is one that's furthest along and I'd like to share it with you. So with Jeff Price, who is at the Burnham Institute and has also founded Vala Sciences, Jeff basically developed what's called a kinetic imaging cytometer. Actually, the idea for it goes back to someone named Pat McDonough, who was at UCSD and SDSU and is now at Vala. And the idea was to convert a high-throughput microscope into a system where you can image in 384 format any excitable cell using optical dyes. And then you can segment the images into images of individual cells and get kinetic data for every single cell. Okay? And so you can learn a lot about what's going on in the individual cells, and you could use this for high-throughput screening. So you can measure data. You can measure the calcium transient or voltage in the nucleus, around the nucleus, in the cytoplasm, all over. So you can get different kinetic parameters for different portions of the cell. So, and you can see effects with a lot of known drugs. I'm going to just flip through this. And we've been collaborating with Roger Chen's lab here at UCSD. And Roger and Evan Miller in Roger's lab has made a fabulous voltage dye. It works very differently from the electrochromic dyes that you're used to for recording voltage. It is a so-called molecular wire and works by a photo-induced electron transfer that quenches the fluorescence. And so this is an image of cells, of cardiomyocytes contracting, and the flashing is the depolarization as you visualize it with the dye. Okay? It's a very fast dye, and it's very sensitive, and you get about, I think, 30% change in fluorescence with depolarization. And so that's far better than the traditional electrochromic voltage dyes. So using this dye, using the Valo Sciences instrument, Alex Savchenko in the lab and Wes McKeithen have been doing recordings of, these are action potential recordings. In black here is a normal cardiomyocyte derived from an iPS cell, and in red is treated with an IC50 dose of mexiletine, a sodium channel blocker. It also has other effects on calcium channels and potassium channels, as Rocky has reminded me many times. And so you can see a shift then in the repolarization kinetics. An IC50 dose of TTX, which is a sodium channel blocker, it affects the peak current predominantly, and so then you can see a slowing of the upstroke, and that's quantified over here. And dofetilide, which is a potassium current blocker, potassium currents are needed for the repolarization, and by blocking them, you delay the repolarization. So using this instrument in high throughput, we can look for drugs or modify drugs that affect physiology of cells. So with that in mind, we've then screened for microRNAs that could be considered as therapeutic targets for heart failure. So the goal was to develop an anti-mirror that would block a pathologically upregulated mirror that itself would be bad for you in heart failure. So we've posed three different targets for this. And I'll tell you about the first one because it's furthest along. So basically, we screened for microRNAs that specifically affect that target and then developed an anti-mirror and taken it into animals. So we used a very simple screen that's now commonplace. You can actually buy constructs like this that have a reporter, luciferase, or GFP, and you fuse the target, whatever target sequence you want, to the GFP or luciferase. And then you screen for microRNAs individually in 384 well plates that suppress the luciferase or GFP, in this case, signal. And gives you your microRNAs in yellow here. They're inhibitory of the GFP, and then the p-value is in the y-axis here. And so they have statistically significant inhibition of the target sensor construct. So that yielded out of the whole murome 144 mirrors, of which 82, when we did a dose response validation, confirmed. And then of those, 32 are evolutionarily conserved from humans. This is human screen, so conserved in mice, because we need to test them in mice. We can't test them in humans right away. And of those 32, 15 are upregulated in heart failure. This was just not just our samples, but samples from a beautiful RNA-seq paper published about 6 months ago. So of those 15, we took those and asked which of those will actually slow the calcium kinetics using the kinetic imaging cytometer. And in particular, this mirror was very good, as well as a number of others. So we focused on this one here. And we built an anti-mirror that will cancel its activity. So you have the effect of the microRNA. You have the effect of the microRNA, and you have the effect of the anti-mirror blocking it right there. So then we took those in vivo. So if you take the anti-mirror, you take an animal in a long-term heart failure model. You go out for 3 months, that's heart failure. You start injecting in the anti-mir or a control sequence. At 3 months' time, we look serially every month after that for the function effect on the heart by echocardiography. And what we find is that relative to sham-operated animals, control anti-mir animals, you can see that the microRNA goes up, and the anti-mir brings that back down. Okay, and the target protein has the opposite course. And this is the most important slide. So here, if you look by echocardiography, you can look at the function of those hearts, get a preliminary evaluation of function. So if we look at ejection fraction or fractional shortening, two indices of cardiac function, you can see, and you look at 3 months, when we start to dose it in, you can see a decline. You dose in the specific anti-mir, it halts the progression, and in fact, you get an improvement in the function of the heart, measured by either of these indices. The control anti-mir injected animals continue to decline. In fact, half of them die by the end of the experiment. And by hemodynamics, it bears that out. The ones with heart failure and the control, they're very bad out here. They're very dilated hearts, not working very effectively, looking at a load-independent measure of heart function or ejection fraction. You can see that the control animals are doing poorly. The specific ones are doing much better. Fibrosis is also, to some extent, normalized. So in summary, then, I've shown you that we can use the kinetic imaging cytometer, in this case as a secondary assay, to identify RNA, microRNAs that perhaps have a pathological effect. And if you look at those that are upregulated in heart failure, overlay those two, identify potential targets for intervention. So I've tried to acknowledge people as we go along, but in particular, these are the people in the lab who have done much of the work. And I'd like to in particular acknowledge the chemists with whom we couldn't do any of this work, from HBRI and John Cashman's lab, and the engineers, Jeff Price and his collaborators at Valo Sciences. Thank you. So I think, like the last few sessions, we'll take questions following the speakers, and then...
Does your miRNA data, which I assume you're increasingly getting more of all the time, sort of go back and validate that initial connection diagram that was derived from the informatics?
Oh, yes. I don't quite understand your question. So we deduce from the targets of the microRNAs plus proteins that interact with them one step away, you can create a protein-protein interaction network for the biological process. But computational algorithms are terribly error-prone. So you have to go through and experimentally verify that the nodes in that network are biologically meaningful.
So I'm wondering, can you take your miRNA library and sort of overlay it on that and sort of get a connectome at the
regulatory
level?
Sorry, so that network is derived from the microRNA screening. It is the hits. Sorry, I should have explained that better. It's the hits of the microRNAs that work in the biological assay. We take those mirrors, we computationally predict their targets, and assemble the network. But then a lot of work must be done to verify that that network is real. And in fact, most of the pathways turned out not to be very important, but the TGF-beta pathway that wove through there was terrible, was responsible.